Well, we're getting down to the wire. If anything, if this works right.
You have more time in this session, so.
Okay, good. I'm hoping that we might have a little time for Q&A afterwards. Got an extra microphone. If we do have time, the only way we'll do it so that we don't just have people making statements is just align with the microphone and one at a time ask question. But if we do that, we want to really keep it concise and clear just for questions, not statements. So as I said, we're getting a little closer, even closer to Sunday now, so I can preach a little bit more. I want to show you a couple of things that are important, because whenever I address a group of Christians, they invariably express ideas of confusion. Well, I don't understand how this relates to Bible prophecy. Anybody have that idea right now? Are you wondering how this might relate to Bible prophecy at all? I hope so. So I'm going to show you a couple of things, and Psalm chapter 2, verses 1 to 3 is really interesting. This is also quoted in Revelation as well. Why did the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? Now, this is what's going on. They're reimagining the world right now. They're imagining a vain thing. I mean, this just jumped off the page at me. It's exactly what they're doing. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together, that's who we're talking about, against the Lord and against his anointed, that would be us, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. In other words, quit telling us what to do. That's the idea. Get away from us. We don't want to know about, what your constraints are. But having said that, there's a lot of similarities about what's going on today, I'm sure, and what went on, for instance, back in Genesis with the story about the Tower of Babel, where scientists of that day got together with a new technology that was cutting bricks out of stone and using tar to stick them together. Before that, they built houses with rocks and mud, clay, and they weren't very stable. You might imagine a little shaking of the earth, strong wind could blow a house over. So when this new technology came along, the bricks and the tar, they discovered that they could build much, much higher than they could with rocks. And then somebody came along, namely the character Nimrod. And Nimrod started to build this tower. And he said, guys, we've got this now. We've got this. We can build a tower right into heaven. It's so good. Our new technology is so good that we could stick these things together like Legos up into the sky, up into space or whatever. Maybe even up to where God is, and we can grab him by the shirt collar and drag him down here on earth. That might have been in their mind, maybe not. But the technology that they had deceived the people into thinking they could actually build a tower into heaven. You go study the story yourself, you'll see. We have technology today that's being offered in the same way. We have genetic engineering, we have molecular manipulation, we can create matter out of nothing now, we can shape it and form it any way we want. Why, we've got this new technology that literally can propel us into a state of immortality. How's that for a promise? And people are believing the technology because of the technology that's held out to them. They believe it. And they think, we can do this, just like they said back at the Tower of Babel. And you know that story didn't end too well for those people, right? God said, no, I'm not going to do that. Confused their languages, and they scattered like fleas. But the idea, especially if you look around that time in the Old Testament, the great cities that were built back then, including Babylon, the great cities of the world, quite apparently, of that day, were built in direct opposition to what God had prescribed. And there were lots of warnings given to the cities of that day, think like Nineveh, for instance. Lots of warnings given to those cities to repent because they were doing stuff they shouldn't have been doing. They got together and did stuff they shouldn't have done. So I want to put a focus on where the whole concept today in the mind of the global elite is regarding cities And it's just going to, I'm going to show you a short clip of an industry promo that was made recently. Well, not recently, it's probably been a few years now, that talks about global cities. And this is a little bit on the spooky side, but you'll get the idea. Just listen.
I am alive, vibrant with possibility, a magnet for young creative talent, the engine for a knowledge economy. A river runs through me. There are many tributaries to my capital flows. I am an urban regenerator, a startup incubator, a creator of new opportunities, the catalyst for technological innovation, a laboratory for creative ideas. I am ever evolving, fusing the ancient with the modern, a transforming digital infrastructure. My social network's as diverse as my population. I am a host to opportunity, a home to establishment, a seat of academic learning, a cultural hub, a tech city, a de-zoned, mixed-use melting pot of people and ideas. I am the future, a millennial possibility, a corporate HQ, a growing business idea, an Olympic destination, an investment opportunity. I am a global city.
Wow, huh? Isn't that interesting? We see this doctrine of the global city emerging all around the world with with the city's concept of the city-state replacing the concept of the nation-state. We have, in our country, we have Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York especially, all consider themselves at this point, well, San Diego's trying to be a come-along, trying to figure themselves to be global cities. You have other cities of the world, certainly, that are great cities. You have Munich, you have London, you have cities in Asia that are giant cities that are all tied into this master supply chain now, where everything is just-in-time transportation from here to there, building this network of cities now to kind of be the dominant structure of the world, because they figure, and they say wrongly in some sense, that they say that everybody's moving to the cities, and that's where we need to get everything cooking, is in the cities. That's also one reason there's been such a battle against the rural communities in the world. We feel it here in America, where people in the rural community are, the pressure is on to sell and to move to the cities, move to the population centers, rather than stay in a rural environment. So what I want to show you here in any case, a couple of things, two different things that may help you to understand about something about Bible prophecy maybe that you didn't understand before. Because if you're a student of the Bible, I would encourage you, you should anyway, naturally, I encourage you to go home at some point while this is still fresh in your mind, dig out your Bible and start reading about what you know about Bible prophecy, maybe from the book of Revelation, maybe Daniel, maybe Ezekiel, whatever. Start reading some of that stuff again to see if any of this sparks an idea in your head, you know, the connection, connecting the dots. I think you'll see some, honestly. But I hear two places of confusion that I've had repeatedly said to me over the last several years now. I'm going to give you just an idea on both of them. One has to do with, well, and people ask, well, is this the beast system that's coming? Is this the beast system? And I hear all kinds of different, you know, different ideas and stuff around that. But in the book of Revelation, this is just something to keep in mind. In the book of Revelation, there is the concept of a religious Babylon. We see this in chapter 17. And it says, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abomination of the earth. That's the religious Babylon. And then we see in the next chapter, the commercial Babylon presented. Okay? It says, standing afar off, that's the shipmaster, standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, the great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour thy judgment is come. These are two different cities in view, but they both have the word Babylon admitted, you know, in the center of them. And people get confused on that pretty easily, saying, well, it kind of goes back and forth. You know, which is it? Is it a system or is it a city or some combination thereof? So I'm going to give you some quick distinctors between these two Babylons. And you can take it for what it's worth. The slides will be up, right? So you can take this and chew on it if you want. In the left column, Revelation 17, religious Babylon. In the right column, Revelation 18, commercial Babylon. Here are some distinctives between the two mentions of Babylon here. The focus of the first one is Babylon as a system. The second one, the focus is Babylon as a global city. Okay, they're two different things. One is a system, one is a global city. Secondly, the timing of these, the timing of the fall of the religious Babylon, it falls midway in that seven-year period of the tribulation. It falls before the abomination of desolation, whereas the commercial Babylon falls at the end of the seven-year period. Next, the destroyer of the religious system are the ten kings. And you see that in Scripture. It's very clear. The ten kings are the one who eat up and destroy the religious system of Babylon. However, at the end of the period of time, 7 years, it's Jesus Christ himself who brings judgment on commercial Babylon. So there's two, the time periods are different. And lastly, when the religious Babylon is destroyed by the ten kings, there is no mourning. Nobody cries over her, if you will. But when Revelation 18, when commercial Babylon is destroyed, it says very clearly there is great mourning as all the shipmasters stand off in the with their ships and stuff, with their precious cargoes that they had gotten rich from bringing the cargo to the city. They were mourning because their whole gravy train had just been disrupted. It kind of reminds me of what happens when you're feeding your dog and you accidentally kick the dish over. You know, it's like the dog goes berserk. My food isn't in my dish anymore. So those are some distinctives in any case that you can kind of think about as you're trying to figure out the difference between religious Babylon and commercial Babylon. They're two different things in the book of Revelation. The second observation that I want to bring to you that's a point of confusion is what the concept of the world is. And the word WRLD is used throughout Scripture, but many people don't quite grasp the understanding. There's different words used for the word world. English language is kind of messed up in a lot of ways. And so the Greek language and even in Hebrew, there's different concepts that are expressed that we had to put it in English. They use the word world. But point number one here, the interpretation of the world when the underlying word is cosmos means the order of things. It's like the kingdoms of the world that's ruled by the God of this world. We see Jesus was tempted after 40 days of fasting. The devil took him up to a high place and said, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world if you just worship me. He said, no. I'm sure in his mind he's thinking, I'm going to get him later on anyway, so why would I want to take him from you now? But the kingdoms of the world he was talking about was the cosmos. The cosmos. There's an English word we get from that, by the way. It's transliterated. Can you guess what it is? Cosmetics. Ladies, some of you are wearing cosmetics, right? I'm not going there. But the idea of cosmology is to mask what's underneath, is to disguise what's underneath. And the cosmos is the perfect representation of that. The devil puts lipstick on the pig to make it look good, right? And those kingdoms of the world have been existent ever since Adam and Eve fell in the garden. The kingdoms came shortly thereafter. But the system of things, how it operates together, that has been what the God of this world rules over. On the other hand, point number two, the earth, the creation of God, has always been and will always be the property of God. He has not given up control or ownership over the physical world. And there's plenty of verses in the Old Testament that say that. For instance, Haggai 2:8 says, the gold and silver are mine. Talking about all the gold and silver in the world, they're mine. Lots of verses in the Old Testament that point out that the physical world is under ownership directly by God himself. Now, this is important to realize because what's going on here in the world today, what is being destroyed? Where are the attacks coming from? Where are they headed? And here's the point. Them that destroy the earth, Revelation 11, 18, we talked about, these are some of the things that are pointed directly at God's creation as if to put a finger in his eyeball. You know, you say you're the creator. They don't believe in creation. They don't believe in intelligent design. But, you know, down deep, they couldn't do all this stuff without recognizing deep down that there is a God, and we're taking away authority from him. We're taking away his creation. The heck with his creation. It's our creation now, basically what they're saying. So you have transhumanism. Who owns you? Who created you? Well, the Bible's pretty clear about that, right? You were knitted together in your mother's womb. Until the day you die, you are his, and even after that, you're his. If you're a believer, of course, you'll be in heaven. If you're not, you're going to face the great white throne judgment someday. Don't want to do that, for sure. But God has retained ownership over the human body, over humans, from day one until day N plus whatever. So when transhumanism comes along, what's it attempting to do? Change God's creation. It's a direct assault on his authority to maintain his ownership. How about shutting down energy throughout the world, which energy is being controlled now? Energy was given to us first by the sun. God put this in place. The photosynthesis process, plants build things for us to eat. Animals eat the grass. We eat the animals. All this stuff works in harmony. It's all dependent on energy. Now they're attempting to shut down and control energy, a direct assault on God's authority. Shutting down carbon dioxide. We are carbon-based units, right? We breathe out carbon dioxide. The plants breathe in carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen. We breathe the oxygen. There you go, right? It's a nice little cycle. We couldn't live without the plants, and the plants couldn't live without us. So when somebody wants to shut down CO2 in the atmosphere, they're not only making an attack on humanity itself, but they're making an assault directly against God, saying your CO2 cycle isn't good enough. We're going to replace that somehow. Shutting down nitrogen fertilizers. This is the big trend today. This is what happened in Sri Lanka. Resulted in the whole country collapsing. The people were so mad, they ran the president off. He fled the country, and I think he's still in exile. I don't think he'll ever go back. But they're starving there because the president decided in all of his malevolent wisdom that he followed the United Nations says, cut back on nitrogen fertilizer to your farmers. And he said, I can go one better. I'll just cut out fertilizer altogether. So he stopped shipping fertilizer to the farmers. Of course, all the crops went bust and the people went bust. People were hungry and they got madder than a wet hornet. Shutting down food and agriculture in general. We know there's a war on the family farm all over the world. We know there's a war on red meat and cattle because they say, well, after all, they flatulate too much and they release methane into the atmosphere and, oh my gosh, we're all going to die because of it. Now they're talking about dimming the sun. Well, that'll take care of global warming. We'll dim the sun. By golly, we'll put particles in the upper atmosphere and we'll reflect the sunlight back into space. Who needs it? The heck with it. You want to say thanks, guys, after you just got done giving us solar panels that need sun to operate. Now you're going to dim the sun? This is not going to end well, for sure. Very short-sighted. But dimming the sun, so-called geoengineering, is absolutely insane because God gave us the sun to keep the earth working the way it's supposed to work. And now on top of that, you have genetic engineering, which of course is designed to change man fundamentally from the inside. Again, a direct assault on God's ownership of the physical world. All of these attacks are against the physical world. That's my point. So when Revelation 11, 18 says, them who destroy the world, it's not too difficult to make a connection here between the people who are doing what they're doing today, and it's going to get worse, not better, before we're done with this. Could get a lot worse. They could actually dim the sun. They haven't quite done it yet, But many of you have seen the streaks in the sky that go from, 200 miles long. That's not a contrail. I grew up next to Beale Air Force Base in Northern California, which is the headquarters for the Strategic Air Command back in when I was growing up in the 60s. And they had those big, giant B-52 bombers flying in and out of there. Oh, they were magnificent. We had one of them crash in our field one time, one of our properties. It was horrible. But I used to watch them fly around and land. They're just marvelous to watch. And you see them up way up high in the sky because a lot of times they circle over the airbase till they got up and then they zoom off. And they would routinely have contrails behind them. Short ice crystals formed because they're flying in, it's real freezing temperature up there. It would create a mist. The mist would freeze and reflect light. And they call it a contrail. They would typically be anywhere from 5 to 15, 20 miles long, maybe. But what we see in the skies today are far from that. They're not contrails. They're something else. A lot of people call them chemtrails, geoengineering, whatever. But they're already putting some substances in the atmosphere that are designed to filter out sunlight, keep it from getting so warm down here, perhaps changing weather patterns as well. And then lastly, genetic engineering is bad enough, but lastly, taking over the whole area of intelligent design, all throughout Scripture, God elevates himself as being the designer of creation, period. These people now are saying they are the designer of creation, and they'll take it from here. Now, I'll introduce you to a guy by the name of Parag Khanna. He's a young, good-looking, articulate, well-educated technocrat that is a professor at the U School of Public Policy in Singapore. It's one of the top technocratic schools in the world. He's a professor of economics and political science. Esquire magazine a couple years ago put him in the 75 most influential people of the 21st century. He jets around the world talking to the global elite. They love him at the World Economic Forum. He talks to governments. He talks to big commercial groups. He's pretty much everywhere. He's a prolific author, and he wrote a book called Connectography, one of his books, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization. It's an interesting book. I wouldn't recommend that you buy it necessarily, but if you wanted to read something from his perspective, it's an interesting book to read. Well, Khanna wrote this in his book, in the introduction, and this is really telling, especially when it comes to the concept of Bible prophecy. He says, we're building this global society without a global leader. Key, global order is no longer something that can be dictated or controlled from the top down. Key statement. Globalization is itself the order. Now, when I read that the first time, it really kind of spoke to me in a way I'd never considered before. Because we're trained to think in terms of dictators. We're trained to think in terms of a Hitler or a Stalin or a Pol Pot or some other crackpot that wanted to take over the world. That's not what's happening here. What they are saying internally to themselves is we're building this system where globalization is the order of things. That takes you right back to the concept of scientific dictatorship where everything is run by algorithm, right? And this is the way they're proceeding. This is how they have put the building blocks of society together in the world to become a system that will be self-sustaining whether or not there is a person at the head of it or not. Is this sinking in? I can't read your faces exactly. This is pretty revolutionary thinking. There's not a person or a group of people. The system is the order. Now, you might speculate that there will be a day as this globalization thing has been built up, it is the system, it is the algorithm, if you will, that there might be a day when one comes upon the scene in the world that the Bible calls the Antichrist, which doesn't mean he's against Christ, it means he's in place of Christ. He presents himself as Christ. He looks like that figure, a lamb, a person of wisdom, a person of peace, to bring peace to the world. We could make a stretch and say, well, this system, whatever it is going to be waiting for him when he finally comes along. It's going to be an interesting thing to have a federal head at that point to say, okay, I'm the top dog now, and this is my system. Maybe he's building that system right now as we speak. So I want you to remember how we got to where we are. Triadal Commission plus technocracy, that's their symbol, the monad. Some of you know that as the yin-yang symbol. It's a kind of an occult symbol that means balance. Balance is the whole thing that sustainable development is all about, balancing the resources of the world against the population of the world, balance. So the Trilateral Commission took over this whole thing, technocracy, fed it to the United Nations, which in turn fed it to the rest of the world and all these various initiatives and stuff that we have today. Whether it be the Earth Summit in 92, whether it be Agenda 21 or the 2030 Agenda, the New Urban Agenda, they've always got some new thing cooking up in their, you know, conferences and stuff they have. And it's much deeper than what I have expressed so far. A lot of other stuff involved in it. Finance is a big part of it, for sure. But this is how it happened. When David Rockefeller started this whole thing in the 1973, his problem as a banker was that now that gold has been decoupled from the dollar, he knew mathematically there'd be a finite end to fiat currency. Yet he's one of the wealthiest people in the world, according to money. What can you do to protect your wealth if you know money is going to ultimately be destroyed, be irrelevant? What do you do? There's only one thing you can do, is in a sense pretend you're Job and start to gather the resources of the world together to yourself, the land, the timber, the farms, the oil, you know, all the mineral wealth of the world. Bring the assets of the world into your direct control. And then it doesn't matter what money is out there, because people are going to want what you have, and you say, well, how much will you give for them, right? This is kind of an old-time con job that's been around for a long time, tricking people out of personal property and governments out of their national treasures. But they've been running this process for decades now, twisting land out of the hands of nations into individual nation states, putting it into the hands of the United Nations as wilderness zones, as heritage zones, you name it, takes it out of production in the country. The country can't do anything with it. Development is shut off. The United Nations, meanwhile, is gathering up prime resources all around the world to be held in global common trust for these people to access it when they see fit. It's a simple con, but there's a lot of details to it as we go through the decades on how they have accomplished this con, but it's working. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That's the whole point. Take it away from anybody that's got it. This is not socialism. Socialism at least gave you back something. These people are creating a form of neo-feudalism where you get nothing. They want it all. If you get crumbs in their mind, you'll be lucky. Klaus Schwab says by 2030, which is only 7 years away, you will own nothing and be happy. And everybody goes, ha, 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 Klaus. Funny joke, Klaus. No, he's not joking. He's dead serious. By 2030, he really believes, according to their plan right now, that we the people and we the nation states of the world, we will own nothing, and somebody has to own it though, right? They will own it. They'll lease it to us, pay-per-view, like Netflix, you know, or a Prime subscription where you get shipping paid or something. They'll lease it to us, but we will not be allowed to own it. No private property means the economic system is going to go straight down the tubes. Straight down the tubes. Well, there's some leftover thoughts that I want to cover here. We've got time to do this. I didn't address this, but it needs to be addressed just because it does. The first thing is artificial intelligence, in particular ChatGPT. If you're not up on ChatGPT, you should be. Just search for it on anywhere, and you'll come up with a bunch of articles, including on technocracy.news. This is a new concept of artificial intelligence that just debuted last November, and in force, where it's available to the public, it's only been a couple of months now. In that very short period of time, there now today are over 100 million adopters that are using ChatGPT as an artificial intelligence system to draw information out of the internet that may or may not be true, that may or may not be woke. The only thing for certain is it's not written by a human, it's written by the artificial intelligence program. This technology will be the most disruptive technology of 2023, looking backwards. It will disrupt education, because now students, for instance, can get term papers written by the chat AI algorithm. They can put in the criteria that they want, whatever the teacher assigned to them, and say, I want you to write it in my style, blah, 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 and whatever. Well, how many words do you need? Well, I need 850 words. And within seconds, the whole text of their term paper will be delivered to them. No mind, their own, they don't need to exercise their own mind at all. Just put their name on it, type it up, boom, here you go, teach. And here's my paper. Journalists are using ChatGPT to write articles now. Sports Illustrated just announced that from now on, they're going to use ChatGPT to write articles for their magazine. I don't know what they're going to do with the swimsuit magazine, but maybe they'll have ChatGPT draw up some women, you know, in bikinis or something. Who knows? But this is going to sweep the journalism world. Because if you don't have to think about it, if somebody else can do your work, you know, at least in their mind, that's a good thing. I don't have to do any work in this. I'm still get paid like a journalist, and I can pump out twice as many stories, maybe get a few more bucks. But when it dawns on the editors that ChatGPT can do a better job than their paid editors can, the human editors, you know what's going to happen to them? Out the door. Goodbye. Don't need you anymore. We'll just put ChatGPT on a schedule, just give it an automatic recurring task every morning, write 10 articles that have to do with the news of the day, the most top trending stories. You get your whole magazine produced for you every day. The legal profession, ChatGPT passed the bar in California all by itself. It's passed every intelligence test that's been thrown at it so far. Insurance financial advisors, same thing. It knows everything about the financial world and about all the laws and tax laws, regulation. It's consumed all that stuff into its knowledge base. And so you can see how this is going to be disruptive. And it's spreading like wildfire right now. 100 million users in the course of 2 months. It's expected by the end of this year there's going to be 1 billion users across the planet. What it's going to do to the human mind, it's going to atrophy the human mind for a lot of people because they won't have to exercise anymore. But it also is going to feed misinformation and propaganda to people so that they will very subtly be guided to a new understanding of the world. It's going to be disruptive. It's going to be earth-shaking for our society. Honestly, we'll look back a year from now and we'll understand more about what it actually will do. I can't really predict all the subtleties to it, but I can see this is going to be the major thing of 2023 and going into next year as well. So much for ChatGPT. What about the war in Ukraine? That's another big thing on people's minds. Who started it? Why did they start it? How did we get? Are we headed for World War III in short order? Nuclear exchange of some kind? Maybe. If the war hawks have anything to do with it, you'd think that's what they have in mind, is to start a global war. But when the war in Ukraine started, there was three things that happened. One was there was an agricultural crisis immediately because Ukraine is one of the richest farming countries in the world. And when Ukraine was disrupted, and of course, Russia is the largest exporter of wheat in the world. When that relationship was disrupted, all of a sudden, the food production industry throughout the world started to stumble forward. Okay, those of you who are close to ag, you know what I'm talking about. It's just things just started to degrade. The old man was stumbling in his gait. And all kinds of things have come out of that. Now we have We have the Netherlands now, that the UN has convinced the Netherlands to pull back nitrogen-based fertilizers by 30%. The farmers there say, we're out of business, we're done. So we're fighting you guys. So they took tractor caves to the streets, and they've had several confrontations. The government shot at a few of them along the way. It's going to get violent before it's done, but the farmers figure, we got nothing to lose, we might as well. We're dead otherwise. We're done. The land we farm sometimes for generations and generations, it's going to be stripped out of their hands, stripped away from them. You know how that feels. Very difficult. So the food industry was disrupted. The energy industry was completely turned upside down too, because Europe gets most of its energy from Russia. That was, you know, that led to headlines where, you know, Europeans are going to freeze, there's going to be, you know, tens of thousands of people die in a cold because they don't have gas, natural gas. And that had repercussions all around the world. So now the United States is shipping liquid natural gas to Europe, the stuff that we should be using for ourselves to be self-sufficient again. So energy was the second thing. The third thing was finance. The financial world was disrupted by the war in Ukraine. And you say, well, how's that? Well, when the sanctions were put on Russia to suppress their economic activity with the rest of the world, and at the same time, a funnel was opened up to funnel Western money especially into Ukraine with no end in sight, all of a sudden the financial system throughout the world started showing stress cracks. And it's still doing that today. We can thank the war in Ukraine for all three of these major, major things. Well, we've talked about energy, finance, and food. These are the three major areas concerned to technocrats and to transhumans at this point. Exactly how does that equate to the war in Ukraine? You can figure that out. But I think it was pretty telltale to me, in my mind, that this was intentional to do this. And a lot of people believe, of course, that Russia was egged into Ukraine by the United States in particular. They don't cross this line, and they finally did. What about 5G connectivity and 6G, which is coming? You think 5G was bad, wait until you get a hold of 6G. I got an article up on Technocracy News right now that talks about the new 6G under development as we speak. 5G was created, according to the people at like Verizon, T-Mobile, etc., with the thought that anything that can be connected will be connected. This is the Internet of Things, which is a network of sensors, whether it be thermostats in your home or smart TV or sensors in a street or license plate readers or cameras taking pictures of everybody. Things that can be connected will be connected to collect data. And the Internet of Things and the so-called Internet of Everything, which includes humans, they're looking at using 5G to connect everything together so that they can suck a real-time flow of data off of everything in society. This hasn't been done quite yet, but they're working on it really hard. And while 5G has just come up now, 6G is being talked about right now, design phase. You read about it, it will absolutely blow your mind. If you had a hard time processing 5G, you're really going to have a hard time processing 6G. It really is amazing. 5G operates in a megahertz frequency band. 6G is going to operate up into the terabit frequency range, which is like an order of magnitude higher. It's very futuristic in sight. It's going to be a key technology for pushing forward with this whole technocracy idea and controlling the world by algorithm. So that's something to watch. 6G isn't coming right now, probably won't for 6-7 years from now, but 5G is here right now, and it's being used to connect things together so that the flow of data can flow back to central places to be analyzed by artificial intelligence, including things like ChatGPT. Lastly, what can you do? This is the question I most frequently ask. What can we do? Is there anything we can do to push back on this globally? Globally, I'm going to say no. There's nothing you can do. You can't even get a hold of Washington these days, can you? And maybe you know somebody in Washington that's like a senator or somebody up there, a big mucky muck. where you can call them up on the phone and say, hey, I want you to think about this. Even if you do, the odds of anything happening as a result are pretty slim. So from a national, certainly from a global level, there's nothing we can do. We have no association as people with the European Union, for instance, or any other place. No China, no India, no. We can't do anything on a global basis. What about a national basis? Washington, D.C. is probably a lost cause right now as far as this stuff is concerned. Not that they couldn't rise up and do something, but they're not. What about the state level? Well, a lot more can be done at the state level for sure, and there are things happening at the state level that are pushing back on this whole technocracy slash transhuman meme. You can educate your state legislators much more easily because they're from your hometown. You can get an audience with them. You can influence them. You can feed them information and say, guys, we need to be protectors. Your job is to protect us out here in the country or whatever. You need to start thinking out ways you can put up legislation that will block this garbage from coming in and destroying our state. Maybe they respond, maybe they weren't. But your last line of defense is where you live, your city, your town, whatever it might be, your unincorporated area. The areas where you live at this point are probably the most important things that you can protect and build. I look at it, building a firewall around your community where you can transform and reform where you live into blocking this stuff out as much as you can. And there's many things that cities can do with binding resolutions that can block much of the things that we're talking about here from coming in and affecting them. They can make binding resolutions over the World Health Organization, for instance, dictating policies, health policies on when the pandemic, what shot you take, blah, 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 you know, all this kind of stuff that happened during COVID. That all could have been blocked at the city level, at the county level, and even at the state level, it could have been blocked. In Florida, I believe now they're talking about anti-masking legislation. I think it's already been passed that says that we're not going to ever do that again. We're never going to have masking again. It's a mandate. If you want to wear a mask, that's your problem, but not going to be mandated. So the city level has a lot of possibilities for you to be involved. Get a seat at the table. And with that, I want to introduce you to an organization that I started in 2018 called Citizens for Free Speech. Citizens for Free Speech. The First Amendment, you all know, Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I hope you all know these 5 points by heart. But the fact is, the founders of our Constitution put the First Amendment in the first place on purpose because they believed that these particular rights were given by God, not by man. This is important because if man didn't give them, man can't take them away. They're inherent, they're innate to us as people, as individuals. And I've heard this from other countries, by the way, people in other countries crying out for free to defend free speech and freedom of the press. They don't have a First Amendment. But they certainly understand the importance of free speech and freedom of the press and freedom of worship, etc., in their countries because they see it when it's squelched as a loss of freedom, immediately a loss of freedom. That's what the founders of our nation put in here, and they said, look, Congress, keep your hands off these unalienable rights. They are not yours. Get it through your thick, headed skulls. They're not yours to meddle with. Now, what's happened in the last couple of years, especially 3 years? Free speech has been the first thing that got meddled with. Face masks came out. You can't have free speech when you're wearing a face mask. Sorry, you can't. 40% of the population will attest to it are hearing impaired. We need to see people's lips, or we can't hear them. We can't understand them. A lot of you have perfect hearing and you still can't understand somebody with a mask. You have to get closer, like at the shop, you know, the clerk at the shop. What did you say? Your cashier. Could you repeat what you just said? Because they're wearing a mask. Can't understand them. And if you're wearing a mask and they're wearing a mask, it's like it doesn't work at all. How many churches were shut down at the beginning of COVID? They're still being shut down. It dealt a fatal blow to all the weak-kneed churches that some of them probably should have gone out of business, but that's not the point. They had the freedom to stay or to go out of business. They should have. But approximately 7,500 churches got killed during the first year of COVID when the lockdowns occurred. That's huge. Huge. And people would think, well, boy, I'm sure glad that's over, man. Now churches are just cruising on. They're back to normal. No, they're not. The whole industry, if you will, of churches across America are still stumbling and being crushed and just going out of business left and right. Some 4,500 this year are going to go out of business. They were here yesterday. They're going to be gone tomorrow. A number of reasons. Churches have been under attack. Freedom of the press, give me a break. Censorship is rampant everywhere. Propaganda is everywhere. The right to petition the government for redress of grievances, they ain't listening to us anymore, people. Folks, you know, they're not. You complain, and it's like in one ear and out the other. Nobody is willing to do anything anywhere to address our legitimate concerns as citizens of this country. And this is even really down many cases to the state level and to the city level. At the city level, however, the people that occupy the seats of your school boards, your fire boards, your water boards, your city council, and all the other elected positions that you have, every one of them live in your community. Every one of them is approachable by somebody to talk to them and try and talk them out of this wokeness and this craziness, these policies that are killing us. Many of them, once they are educated, get it, understand it, and will act on it. But they need to be educated, and you need to get your own seat at the table. When I talk about Citizens for Free Speech, I started this in 2018 because I saw the collusion between Facebook and Twitter, and that was all I saw. I saw somebody on Facebook get knocked off, deplatformed. The next day, they were taken off of Twitter. And I'm watching this happen in both directions. Somebody get knocked off of Twitter, next day they get knocked off of Facebook. What could you conclude? Well, this is my field. I was watching that kind of stuff closely. The only thing you conclude is there's collusion going on here. All of a sudden, they're ganging up together to decide who is going to be censored. And I thought, we are really in trouble here. Big trouble. Because once the collusion is started, it's like gangrene, and it will spread. And if there's an attack on free speech, and here's the problem with this, if there's an attack on free speech, if they are successful at silencing us, the next thing that we can expect is a genocidal wave of dead bodies. Okay, that's a shocking statement. I hope that shocks you to think about it. Some of you have heard of the European psychologist by the name of Dr. His first name skips me. Desmet is his last name. He created a concept of, he's a clinical psychologist, he created a concept of mass formation. Has a lot to do with free speech. I'm not going to talk about mass formation in particular, but I've listened to several of his lectures over time, and he's sensitive to having been raised in Europe, and his family, grandparents, whatever, they're all from Europe. He's sensitive to what happened in Europe, first in Russia and then with Germany. Generationally, they hear all the stories coming down from granddad and, you know. And so he said, in one of his lectures he concluded, he says, so what's the remedy? He says, free speech is the remedy to mass formation. I said, what? That, really? Okay, tell me why. He gets real serious and real quiet. He says, when people are denied the ability to cry out about their condition, the next thing that happens is genocide. It sets up the stage for genocide. And if you think about it, that's exactly what happened in Russia, because Russia attacked the free press. The first thing they did when they went in, they killed all the people who were writing. They didn't have TV broadcasting, but during World War II, they did the same thing. In Cambodia, legendary, they killed all the media, and they replaced them with their own people. Millions of people died in Cambodia, if you remember that, the killing fields of Cambodia, because they could not cry out to the world. We're dying over here. They're killing us. They're massacring us and putting us in mass graves. Help us, world. They couldn't cry out. And they were set up for genocide. You look at the history, the panorama of history, when speech and the ability to communicate is silenced, the people now are sitting ducks for the tyrants to come in and simply just wipe them out because they cannot speak. That is one reason that free speech and maintaining free speech is so important in America, but it's under attack like never before. And I don't care what your issue is. You should have the right to speak about it. You should have the right to collect information about it. If you want to hear it, you should be able to find it. You don't need a Google telling you what you can and cannot listen to. You don't need a social media platform telling you what you can and cannot post or cannot listen to or read. None of their business. Should be none of their business. In a free society, free speech is the first thing that makes that society flourish. Free speech. Even in the academic community, when free speech is censored like it was during COVID, you had world-class doctors and scientists that were, their careers were destroyed because they were denied free speech. Their careers were crushed because they dared to speak the truth about what they knew about what was going on. And these are board-certified, triple-certified, whatever people that should have been the first on the platform to speak. And yet the pseudoscience crowd said, no, you have no right to speak. You're crazy. You're off the wall. You're conspiracy theory. You're killing people. You're going against protocol, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're saying all this stuff that's dangerous. My friend, Dr. Meryl Nass, right now from Maine, is still trying to get her medical license reinstated because the state of Maine took it away from her for daring to talk to her patients, private patients, about things like HCQ and ivermectin during COVID. She didn't lose any patients during COVID, but she got punished. The Maine Board of Medicine decided to pull her medical license and deny her the ability to practice medicine. And she also is a long-career doctor of osteopathy, meaning she's first an MD, and then she goes on to practice, you know, learn more after that. Her life and career has been destroyed. Fortunately, she's a fighter. She's a patriot. She's taken them to the cleaners. But this has been what's happened all across America. Free speech is so important to maintain. And regardless of the issue, you might say, well, I can't do anything for my city council. I don't know anything about education board. I can't do that or whatever. You can't participate in that. Well, I'll tell you one thing you can participate in is upholding and uplifting the concept of free speech. Everybody can do that, regardless of what else you can or can't do. If you're alive and you're breathing and you like to speak yourself and you like to hear what you want to hear, then you should be able to have some say in your own community at that. And even as we talk about this, Charmaine, I don't know where you are, but could you get a couple of volunteers over there to get those newspapers, the Free Speech Statesman? I want everybody in the room to have a Free Speech Statesman as you walk out of here that will tell you everything that I don't have time to talk about here at the stage that we're doing with Citizens for Free Speech. We started in 2018, nonprofit organization. We stumbled along until COVID hit, had about 5,000 members. When COVID hit, our membership exploded. We didn't cause it, it just exploded because people across the country knew something big is going on here and why is free speech being crushed? Today we have somewhere around 65,000 members across the country and we're still growing. People want to maintain free speech. We have 65,000 members in every single state in America. We have training program that we are offering all of our members for free that will equip them to exercise their First Amendment rights in their local community. And a lot of people say, I don't know what I'd say. I don't know how I operate with these people. You know, I don't know them. What do I do? We have a wonderful signature training program called the Citizen Ninja Way that can train anybody to be an effective communicator and a policy changer in their own community. And at the end of the day, when we look through just the concept of free speech, especially in your local community, if you cannot effect policy change where you live, you will not change it anywhere else either. But you can cause policies to be changed in your local community if you're willing to take the time and dig into it and work on it over a period of time, you will change policies in your local community. Now, let me just turn that around just for a minute. If you wonder, how did we get to where we are today? Because nobody paid attention to their local communities. You realize every one of the politicians at the top that we complain about, whether it's Joe Biden or anybody else, Every one of those people started out in somebody's local community. Every single one of them. They started out as a dog catcher or as a city councilman or something. You know, they started their political career in the local community where people had an opportunity to meet them, to talk to them, find out where they're coming from in their mind, what kind of things they want to do for the city, etc. You had an opportunity collectively across the country to deal with these people at your local level. There was a massive failure in America to do that. And as they graduated from the city to the regional to the state level, and then from the state level to the national level, which you know that's the track they all take, by the time they get up to the national level and they're doing all these screwball things and you're just like shocked at how could they do this, and you look at them and they're doing it, harming our country, harming the sovereignty of our country, buying into this technocratic and transhuman nonsense. See, what went wrong? Well, it was the local communities that failed to rein these people in while they had a chance to rein them in. So one benefit of working in a local community is rein them in now. Whatever the people that you get a hold of today are going to be the ones that go up to State House next year, 2 years, 3 years from now. Get a hold of them now. Change policies in your local cities. There's a wonderful story. The city of Huntington Beach in California, a beach city in California, on the coast. There's a 7-member council. Every 2 years, 4 of them, and then 3, is either 3 of them are voted in, 4 or 4 of them are voted in. So they have 7. This year, this last election, 4 seats were up. The 3 that came through automatically were total liberal Agenda 21, Agenda 2030 people that were spouting all this stuff. Activists in the city found 4 people to run for city council as a pack. As a pack. 4 of them ran together, not as individual candidates, 4 of them ran together as a pack. They had a unified message that they sent out to the people in the city. These are the things we need to change to restore life in our city to where it was maybe 20 years ago. This is what we need to do. The people, the voters of the city, responded to that message. They worked their tail off to get the word out to everybody in the city. When election day came, they won all 4 seats. All 4 seats. Now the tables are turned. You got 3 people over here that are totally radical left-wingers and a majority of 4 city council members. And in the course, since November, whenever they got seated, I don't know if it was right in November, maybe December, they now have begun the process of changing policies in Huntington Beach, and the liberal left is screaming bloody murder. But they can't do a thing about it. Because the activists launched a city council that would protect their city. Can you imagine the concept? Actually take care of the people in the city. The people are loving it. It may not last. The next election, they may get all kicked out. Don't know. But right now, they've got a beachhead. Anybody that tells me anymore that you can't do anything in your city, nope, I don't believe it. You shouldn't believe it either. These people have proven the value of local activism. And that's what free speech is all about, you understand, because without free speech, you could not do local activism. You can't speak. You can't write. And if you're denied the ability to speak, write, or gather, or assemble, have protests, etc., you have no local activism. You don't have any national activism either, but you don't have any local activism for sure. Free speech is an existential issue to America right now, aside from all these other things we're talking about. Free speech is existential. I would encourage you to read every page of this short little newspaper that we produced, The Free Speech Statesman, because it tells about all the different programs and stuff we have going. We charge nothing to join. It is free speech after all. I felt bad saying, well, you got to pay $25 to join. No, you can't do that. It's free speech we're defending here. So our members support us individually. It's their choice. If they want to support us, they can. If they don't have money, whatever, we're not going to tell them they can't join and be a part of what we're doing. This is for all Americans. It should be. So we're still here. After all these years, we're still here. And our membership is growing. We've got a podcast we do once a week. You get notice of it from the website. We produce the Free Speech Statesman. It's been distributed to all states around the country in the last 3 or 4 months. We've got our training program that is in-person training, and we also have online training on demand. We've got all these various initiatives and stuff that are going on right now. At this point, all we need is more Americans to fill the seats, if you will. More Americans to get involved and see this as an existential threat. Because the attacks on free speech will not stop. These people are, so to speak, excuse the phrase, they're hell-bent for leather to destroy us. And they know, their strategists know, the way to destroy us is to destroy free speech. And if they do that, they want everything else by default. I'm not ready to let that happen. I hope you're not either. You guys have been a great audience. I appreciate everything that that we've been able to talk about and discuss here. I'll hang around, of course, for Q&A if you want to talk about some stuff after we're done. I don't know if we have to vacate the place right away.
What do you think of this guy?